walker. She walked everywhere, and particularly in London, which she adored. And this is an absolute gem of an essay about walking in London between the hours of 4 and 6 in the evening, particularly in winter when it's dark and there's so much atmosphere, and she describes all this. This section is a little bit of an in-joke between me and Virginia, because I do actually collect first editions of her, and I've got quite a big collection now, and I find them mainly in second-hand bookshops all over the world. And this extract is about second-hand bookshops. Books are everywhere, and always the same sense of adventure fills us. Second-hand books are wild books, homeless books. They've come together in vast flocks of variegated feather and have a charm which the domesticated volumes of the library lack. Besides, in this random, miscellaneous company, we may rub against some complete stranger who will, with luck, turn into the best friend we have in the world. There's always a hope as we reach down some greyish-white book from an upper shelf, directed by its air of shabbiness and desertion, of meeting here with a man who set out on horseback over 100 years ago to explore the woolen market in the Midlands and Wales, an unknown traveller who stayed at inns, drank his pint, noted pretty girls and serious customs, wrote it all down, stiffly, laboriously, for sheer love of it. The book was published at his own expense. It was infinitely prosy, busy, and matter-of-fact, and so let flow in, without his knowing it, the very scent of hollyhocks and the hay, together with such a portrait of himself as gives him forever a seat in the warm corner of the mind's inglenook. One may buy him for 18p now. He's marked 3 and 6, but the bookseller's wife, seeing how shabby the covers are and how long the book has stood there since it was bought at some sale of a gentleman's library in Suffolk, will let it go at that.
Thank you, Jane. That was wonderful. And now we turn to your final reading, which is Shakespeare, Sonnet 15, and a very poignant poem in which love and death, one might say, battle for supremacy. Why do you value this one so much?
Wherever you put the pin, really, on the list of all those sonnets, you come up with gold. But I think this one, in that whole section of ones about love and death and the passing of time, where there is a sort of melancholy and a radiance cohabiting, which you get through Shakespeare. I mean, I find this, I had to have Shakespeare in my collection, because this is somebody I return to all the time, and I thought, well, I'll have a sonnet. And I just sort of picked this one at random because I've just loved it the best, really. Well, not the best, but one of the best. How can you say it's the best?
I wonder if you might hear it, Simon.
When I consider everything that grows holds in perfection but a little moment, that this huge stage presenteth naught but shows whereon the stars in secret influence comment, when I perceive that men as plants increase, cheered and checked even by the selfsame sky, vaunt in their youthful sap, at height decrease, and wear their brave state out of memory, then the conceit of this inconstant stay sets you most rich in youth before my sight, where wasteful time debateth with decay to change your day of youth to sullied night, and all in war with time for love of you, as he takes from you, I engraft you new.
Mm. Many thanks indeed to you, Simon Callow, and to my guest for tonight's Proms Plus literary event, Jane Glover.
Simon Callow read The Literary Passions of Jane Glover in tonight's Proms Plus literary event. The presenter was Rana Mitter and the producer was Gavin Hurd. 20 past eight. Welcome if you've just joined us. Radio 3 live at the Proms of Enike and Le Concert Spirituel at 10:15 this Wednesday evening. BBC Symphony Orchestra filing back onto the platform, and in just a moment they're going to perform Prokofiev's Sixth Symphony. If his Fifth Symphony, premiered in January 1945, was about raising spirits dragged down by 5 years of war, the Sixth, often austere and tragic, was perhaps designed to remember the losses that people had suffered. Something of a miracle that the work was written at all. After the premiere of the Fifth, Prokofiev had fallen down a flight of stairs after a blackout and suffered concussion. He never conducted again and found he was only able to compose at a sluggish pace. He had to get permission from his doctors to travel to Leningrad for the premiere of the Sixth. Tonight's conductor, Zachary Oromo.
Departure from Prokofiev's earliest time. It's a departure from the Fifth Symphony, which he wrote just a very short time before, actually. The Fifth Symphony is confident, it's virtuosic. It has its dark moments, but altogether it's still a kind of life-affirming piece, which this Sixth Symphony definitely isn't. I don't know whether the accident that Prokofiev had whilst actually writing this symphony had an impact. Apparently he was hit by a tram or something and he suffered from a dizziness till the end of his life. But I feel that this Sixth Symphony has been born out of such difficulty and misery and hardship. Unlike in the Fifth, the material comes together in not an easy way at all. There are energies that actually don't belong together at all, and yet they grind against each other. They kind of create this almost unbearable tension of differences, and that's where I think that the special interest in this piece lies.
Well, alas, the work got him into trouble with Andrei Zhdanov, Stalin's musical commissar. It's curious to observe the struggle between the two Prokofievs, he wrote. Here, the melodious, harmonious Prokofiev is often attacked without provocation by the other storming Prokofiev. Just a few weeks after the premiere, Prokofiev, Shostakovich and Kachaturian were all attacked for their formalist perversions and anti-democratic tendencies, alien to the Soviet people and their aesthetic requirements. As a result, the Sixth Symphony soon dropped out of the repertoire and wasn't heard again for many years. So here is Zachary Oromo returning to the platform to conduct the BBC Symphony Orchestra in Prokofiev's Sixth Symphony.
Thank you.
Prokofiev's Sixth Symphony, Zachary Oromo conducting the BBC Symphony Orchestra. The work that Prokofiev started in 1945, finished in 1947. Wonderful picture in the Proms programme tonight of Prokofiev and Yevgeny Mravinsky taking a bow after the premiere of the work in Leningrad, 65 years ago, 11th of October, 1947. bbc.co.uk/proms. You can view the programme for each and every prom online at the proms website. Prokofiev gave the work the opus number 111, the same as Beethoven's extraordinary Last Piano Sonata, a work that he loved. He even contemplated dedicating the score to Beethoven. Woodwind players of the BBC Symphony Orchestra, now the horn players. Trumpets, led by Christian Baraclough. Percussion, Elizabeth Burley playing piano. Sakuyoromo talks about how he thinks the role of the pianist in this symphony might be to represent Prokofiev himself. Oromo now shaking hands with the principal string players. Tomo Keller, guest leader this evening. Oromo, music director of the CBSO for 10 seasons, chief conductor designate of the BBC Symphony Orchestra, a role that he'll take on at the proms next year, standing in this evening at very short notice for the indisposed Jozsi Bielochlávek. I mentioned the crimson bow tie he's wearing. There's a crimson cummerbund as well, so maybe there's going to be a change in sartorial direction with new leadership of the BBC Symphony Orchestra from next year. Who knows? But as Sakuyoromo leaves the stage, the orchestra still on their feet, time to bid you for now goodnight from the Royal Albert Hall. Back to John Shea at Broadcasting House.
Thank you, Petrock. Petrock Trelawney presenting the first of this evening's proms. As ever, you can listen again online via the Radio 3 website for the next 7 days, or we'll be giving another airing to that prom on Radio 3 itself on Friday afternoon from 2 o'clock. And we're back at the Royal Albert Hall in a little over an hour for the second of this evening's proms.
London, appropriately enough, is one of the themes of the 2012 BBC proms. And midway through our first full week of the season, our first late-night prom features music by one of the city's most famous adopted sons. George Frederick Handel's three water music suites and fireworks music get the big period instrument band treatment from Hervé Niquet and Le Concert Spirituel. Up to 80 musicians joining together to evoke resplendent royal occasions on the River Thames and in Green Park. Some of London's favourite classical works come alive in tonight's late-night visit to the BBC Proms, starting at 10:15.
And if you are a lover of Handel's music, well, may I congratulate you on your good taste and tell you that this is a good week for you, because not only do we have that late night prom at 10:15 this evening, but a full evening of Handel tomorrow. His oratorio Judas Maccabeus in a performance conducted by Lawrence Cummings. That's tomorrow night at 7:30. And let me also remind you, Handel is our Composer of the Week. That's with Donald MacLeod every day at 12 noon. Well, back to this evening, and at 9:30, this evening's feature. And over the next 3 evenings, we're giving you another chance to hear Tristram Hunt's series about great British ideas. Tonight, he explores the influence that the economist Robert Malthus has had in India. You can hear that programme, as I say, at 9:30. That's in a little over 20 minutes. Before that, let's have some Mozart. Now, as Rana Mitter mentioned at the start of this evening's interval programme, his guest, Jane Glover, is the author of, among other books, one devoted to Mozart's women. When the composer moved to Vienna in 1781, one of his first piano pupils was Josefa von Auenhammer. She fell in love with him. It doesn't sound as though Mozart reciprocated. He wrote of her, "I dine almost daily with Herr von Auenhammer. The young lady is a fright. But she plays enchantingly, though in cantabile playing she has not got the real delicate singing style. She clips everything." Well, all the same, Mozart did dedicate a number of his violin sonatas to her, including this one in C major, Kirchhoff 296. It's played here by Catherine McIntosh with Geoffrey Govier at the forte piano.
Thank you. Thank you.
Mozart's Violin Sonata in C Major Kirchhoff 296, played by Catherine McIntosh and Geoffrey Govier at the forte piano. And a reminder, in case you missed it, this evening's 20 Minutes programme is available on demand for the next 7 days. You can hear the conductor, Jane Glover, sharing her literary passions with Rana Mitter and the audience at the Royal College of Music. That's in a programme recorded earlier this evening with readings by Simon Callow. Do remember to have a look at the Proms Guide for details of all these Proms Plus events. They take place in the early evenings before just about every prom this summer. And listen again online to tonight's programme via the Radio 3 website. Well, we're back at the Royal Albert Hall for our late-night Handel prom at 10:15, and there's more Handel tomorrow evening.
On Radio 3, from the BBC Proms, Handel's dramatic oratorio, Judas Maccabeus. A morale-boosting tale of military prowess which proved even more popular in the composer's time than his Messiah. A distinguished lineup of Handelians from our own time is headed by John Mark Ainsley. The BBC Proms, live from the Royal Albert Hall. Tomorrow night at 7:30 on BBC Radio 3.
And that's presented by Donald MacLeod, who's also introducing Handel as our Composer of the Week every day this week here on BBC Radio 3. Stay tuned for this evening's feature. That's coming next.
The Olympic Games are coming back to London.
From Friday the 27th of July.
It is the one we've been waiting for.
The BBC is bringing every event.
It is now a time to shine.
From every venue.
This is pressure on now. It's a great buzz around the stadium.
To everyone in the UK.
Whatever you're doing, wherever you are, scream and shout.
The Olympic Games. Never miss a moment. With the BBC.
This is BBC Radio 3, broadcasting on 90 to 93 FM, on digital radio and online. It's now 9:30, and we've the first of three features this week in which Tristram Hunt explores how ideas born in Britain have spread beyond our shores, sometimes with devastating effects. In this first programme, he explores the lasting influence that one of our best-known economists had in India, in Great British Ideas.
Hanging on the wall in the Master's Lodge of Haileybury College in Hertfordshire is a determined-looking portrait of the Reverend Thomas Robert Malthus, with his wispy sideburns, green eyes staring out at us, and hand clutching a text. He looks every inch the Georgian intellectual. But at the dawn of the 19th century, Malthus, one of our greatest economic thinkers, developed an idea that was to have a profound influence on the Victorian age to come, and not just here in Britain. For almost 30 years, until his death in 1834, Reverend Malthus personally taught his ideas right here at Haileybury, but not to schoolboys. Back then, these elegant neoclassical buildings had a rather different role. This was the training college of that extraordinary imperial powerhouse, the East India Company. And so the generations of young men who left here with Malthus's ideas ingrained in their minds went on to rule over millions of Indian subjects, on whom these ideas were to have a deep, sometimes devastating impact. And in more recent decades, Malthusian thinking would continue to resonate through debates on that most basic of questions, how to sustain an ever-growing human population. With me here in what we think were once Malthus's teaching rooms at Haileybury College, looking out onto the quad, is the historian David Arnold of the University of Warwick. David, who was the Reverend Malthus?
He was a clergyman, but in 1798, anonymously, he wrote a tract called An Essay on the Principle of Population, which he then revised subsequently, particularly in 1803, under his own name.
What was the central tenet of Malthusian thinking?
The idea was that there was a finite amount of food available to a population, but that there was a natural and inevitable tendency for population to outstrip that available food supply. Unless you do something to check that population, a whole series of dire consequences will follow. And Malthus's idea was that there were a series of what he called positive checks, meaning principally famine, epidemic diseases, and war. And these would wipe out any population increase above the minimal level that the food supply could meet. However, he also talked about a series of preventive checks. And I suppose in some ways this is what Malthus, as a clergyman, was much more concerned about, that it was possible for people to control their own levels of fertility. Not by contraception, he wouldn't have believed in that in the modern sense at all, but by being reasonable about their ability to reproduce, by marrying late on in life, for example, by only having a few children rather than a large number of them. There begins to be this feeling in the 1790s, 1800s, that there are too many people, particularly too many poor people, and that these represent an impossible burden for any progressive and moral society to cope with.
What did he want the response to be to the problem?
Well, I think his response was twofold. I mean, part of what he was writing in 1798 was a criticism of the way in which the poor law operated in England at that time. People on relief from the parish, charitable relief, were to be paid according to the number of children that they had. So Malthus thought this was an incentive for people, poor people, to have as many children as possible to increase their income from charitable sources. He was trying to make, as it were, a moral as well as a demographic observation that you couldn't allow population to expand indefinitely, or if you did, something dire would happen in the form of famines, epidemics, etc.
And what seems quite extraordinary about that is, as we sit here in Haileybury College and we look out on this neoclassical world, it's so ordered, it's so controlled, it's almost regimented here. And he had a sense that beyond these walls, there was something almost terrifying trying to bring it down.
Yes, and of course the further irony to that is that the people he taught here in the Haileybury College then went out to an India which was not organised in the way that this quad is organised in terms of, you know, rational architecture and a neat layout of lawns and so on. They were confronted with an India which they saw as in many ways tumultuous and potentially constantly in danger of getting out of check. And therefore I think that moral strand in Malthus, that desire to point out the nightmare scenario which could potentially explode any time, was one which appealed to those ex-Haileybury people when they went to India.
Mama, look at my color.
Around me I can see, most immediately, a small gaggle of young children, a lady carrying cowpats, lots of young men in sportswear, and then a range of tiny entrepreneurial shops doing everything from motorbike bodywork to dentistry to a computer point, VCAS Enterprises. Some 20 miles out of Delhi in India, where the modern metro system fades away, stands the village of Kanjawala. And it was in places like this where fresh-faced alumni of Haileybury found themselves in charge for the first time as they set about putting what they'd been taught in Hertfordshire into practice here in India. I've been brought here today by Dr. Minoti Chakravarti Kaul, who has made a specialist study of villages like this and the communal systems that have helped them endure through the centuries. How typical would a village like this have been for those builders of empire in the mid-19th century?
This would have been very typical. In this area, they were inheriting really 1,000-year-old villages.
So these villages have been here an incredibly long time. They've also proved themselves resilient in terms of feeding themselves, in terms of agriculture, in terms of sustaining a population.
Those who were appointed by the East India Company were to record the resilient character of these villages in terms of particularly visitations of natural disasters like famines, which they survived. And they survived because of the kind of strength they garnered through cluster formations, which these villages are. In times of trouble, the smaller villages would cluster around the larger villages because most of these large villages had stores of food.
So what they saw here was a community that, even in the midst of terrible famines, was able to sustain itself and feed itself. So how is this system of self-reliance going to change under the mass of the British imperial system?
The villagers had rules by which they managed the municipal arrangements within the residential site on which we are standing, plus the rules regarding the use of the land which was used for cultivation and pasture. And access to these various resources were governed by minute customary rules which they had previously kept in their mind and recited every now and then whenever these rules were examined again. But with the coming in of the British, these rights could be changed only with the authorities deciding to change it. Hence, therefore, there were sometimes misfits between what was actually true at the ground level and what needed to be changed. And this kind of lack of flexibility is what took away governance to fit in with change completely out of the hands of the village people.
So the organic flexibility of villages like this was lost to the discipline of the young men from Haileybury and the imperial system they brought with them.
Right.
And if they got it wrong, that could have devastating consequences.
Yes, indeed. That, in fact, happened often enough.
So the village of Kanjawala has endured to see the 21st century. But in the second half of the 19th century, thousands of villages like it, their communal self-reliance, often weakened by long years of British administration, found themselves looking famine in the face. In Delhi in 1861, in Orissa in 1866, in Bihar in 1874, and then in 1876, the failure of the monsoon began to spread fear around the southern city of Madras. As this new famine gathered pace, the policy of the supreme government was in the grip of a powerful and rather forbidding figure, Sir John Strachey. Strachey was the finance member of the Viceroy's Council, and as Dr. David Hall Matthews of the University of Leeds explains, he was a hard-line Malthusian.
Strachey is a cold, authoritarian man. He doesn't have great personal skills. He went to Haileybury shortly after Malthus died, so he wasn't taught directly by Malthus, but he was definitely taught within the Malthusian paradigm, if you like. He doesn't have much sympathy for the native population or for the poor population. He believes that there is a scientific way of doing government in which he is expert, and the demonstration of the benevolence of British rule will be to do good governance, and good governance means following the rubrics of classical political economy. When Strachey was a very young man, when he was an assistant collector, so probably in his early 20s, he wrote a note on what you should do about famine during a famine outbreak in the early 1860s, where he describes famine relief as a necessary evil.
All this came to a head right here. I've come to Coronation Park in Delhi. Today, it's looking rather sorry for itself, a mausoleum of empire on the edge of an endlessly expanding city. In the shadow of the ring road is a crumbling semicircle of sandstone plinths bearing decaying statues of imperial icons. To my right is George V, resplendent in his royal robes, removed from the heart of Delhi where he once stood at India Gate. But in January 1877, the deserted landscape I'm now walking through was the epicentre of an eye-popping display of imperial magnificence, of the full pomp and circumstance of the British in India. Here was where the Delhi Durbar took place. With me here on a fresh morning in Coronation Park is the historian Dr. Chandrika Kal of St. Andrews University back in the UK. Chandrika, what was the Delhi Durbar and why was it being held in the first place?
The Delhi Durbar was hosted on the 1st of January 1877 by the Viceroy Lord Lytton to mark the transition of the Indian Empire from the East India Company to the British Crown. It was also meant to proclaim Queen Victoria becoming Empress of India.
So rather than the overgrown bulrushes and the children playing and the men warming themselves by fires this morning, what would we have seen at the Durbar?
This was a tent city that came up to host these 60-odd Indian kings and princes. It was a sea of canvas, gold, blue, red, resplendent in the winter sunshine. And into this enormous city of tents arrived Lord Lytton on the 1st of January at the head of a 3-mile-long procession. Lord Lytton read out the proclamation, reassuring the people of India of the support and love of the Queen Empress as she presided over her new empire.
Famine is beginning to rage in southern India, and yet here we have this great self-celebration of the benevolence of British imperial rule.
The famine began before Lytton was appointed, and the imperial assemblage was planned before Lytton was appointed. However, in responding to increasing press and public criticism in India, Lytton took an attitude that was reminiscent of a kind of racial arrogance. It didn't matter, in other words, how many Indians were dying, as long as Queen Victoria was proclaimed as magnificently as possible in this imperial assemblage.
We know his leading minister, Sir John Strachey, was an ideological Malthusian. What was Lytton's approach to the growing crisis?
I think there's certainly a large dose of Malthusianism. Lytton's approach to famine was to try and spend as little money as possible, try and not create a dependency culture. He was very much against importing of grain because he felt that would lower the market price of grain and therefore not encourage exporters and merchants to import grain.
But Lytton and Strachey had a problem.
The government of Madras wants to intervene. It's buying grain itself, so it's actually participating in grain markets. So it's not observing the principles of free trade and laissez-faire economics. So they decide that they need to send somebody down to Madras to put the government right. And the person who Lytton chooses, and Strachey chooses, is Richard Temple.
On the face of it, Sir Richard Temple was a bizarre choice. 2 years earlier, in Bihar, under a more liberal viceroy, Temple had indeed tackled a famine. But his had been a generous and highly un-Malthusian approach.
Lytton was very critical of Richard Temple's attempts in 1873 and 74 when rice had been imported from Burma, which helped alleviate famine conditions in Bihar and Bengal. This action of Temple's was something that Lytton felt was an extravagant waste of taxpayers' money.
Seeing his chances of promotion slip away, Temple now had to consider adopting a radically different, more Malthusian strategy.
He had come over from Calcutta to Delhi, and he's literally taken aside in the corridor by John Strachey and sent as a famine envoy for the government of India to the government of Madras to put them right. I'll give you the exact quote. "While it is the desire of the government of India that every effort should be made, so far as the resources of the state admit, for the prevention of deaths from famine, it is essential in the present state of the finances, that the most severe economy should be practiced. So spend as little as you possibly can to manage the famine. Don't spend all that is necessary to keep every last farmer alive."
And so, from amid the magnificence of the Durbar here in Delhi's Coronation Park, Sir Richard Temple hurried south to the Madras famine. 2 years earlier, in the face of the Bihar famine, he had spent money freely to save life. Now, he was charged with spending life freely to save money. The iron logic of Malthus was back in control. This is the beach that separates the Indian Ocean from the city the British called Madras, now renamed Chennai. Today, it's a pleasant enough scene with couples sitting by the roaring Indian Ocean, fishermen waiting to take their boats out to sea, and an esplanade lining the beach. But in 1877, it was an altogether different scene when Sir Richard Temple arrived here in the throes of a devastating famine. Already a year earlier, as rumours spread through the drought-stricken countryside, that Madras offered somehow mountains of rice and rivers of ghee, of butter, thousands of emaciated refugees came to this city hoping for help. Instead, they found nothing, and they eked out their lives on this beach, picking up grains of rice from amongst the sand. One of the earliest signs of the horrors going on in the countryside was a family who'd come in from their village and set up camp on one of the busiest streets in Madras, and over the next few days simply died of starvation in front of a horrified populace. But the scenes they'd fled from were even worse. I'm on my way now to the Madras Institute of Development Studies to meet Professor Chilapathy, an expert on the Madras famine, to find out just what impact all this had.
The Great Famine of 1876, it followed a big drought. Nobody thought that would take on this kind of proportion. And put a great moral challenge to the people. And as you will find in many of the contemporary accounts, especially the songs, popular songs, people are always thinking of, when is this going to end?
And what's being explored in that folk song?
The folk song talks about, the utter abject deprivation that the people suffer. It talks about how people dug out practically inedible roots, boiled them and ate them, how they plucked inedible leaves, cooked them and ate them, how children were sold, how families broke,